You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Jeff Dyer is the author of four novels, a number of nonfiction books that have been described as genre-defying, combining elements of fiction, criticism, travel writing, and journalism. His latest volume, otherwise known as The Human Condition, is a compilation of essays, reviews, and other musings. It's published by Grey Wolf Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought Mr. Dyer back to our show. Hi.
Hi. Very happy to be back, too.
So this is really a mix of books that have been published in Britain under other titles?
Yeah. 10 years ago, I published my first volume of greatest hits called Anglo-English Attitudes. And in November, the second volume, which was called Working the Room. So this is a selection of those two selections. There's about, I guess, probably two-thirds of the contents of the new one and a third of the old one, because with the passage of time, my feeling is that some of the pieces in the older volume aren't as good as I was persuaded they were all that while back.
Well, also, certain topical references probably don't mean much anymore, and especially to an American audience.
Yeah, it's funny that, isn't it? When we in England are never bothered when there are American references that don't mean anything to us. But I always find going through the things with editors, you're always very, very touchy if there's some reference that you think won't make sense to an American audience.
Some British politician who was Michael Foot, let's say, gets referred to, and Americans have no idea.
Yeah, that's right. Or actually, the piece I did recently for The New Yorker, I mentioned I think Salisbury's Cathedral was okay, but Sainsbury's, the supermarket, that didn't make the cut. So I like the way that Sainsbury's and Salisbury were near kind of, I don't know, sort of secular and sacred anagrams of each other.
In your introduction, you write that you prefer to read articles by other writers in book form rather than in their original context. Do you think the physical form within bound covers rather than on newsprint or even in a magazine adds weight to the writing?
Yeah. I mean, it's more that I find it incredibly oppressive to have these journals like the LRB, the TLS, the NYRB. I mean, to have them lying around, I don't want to become one of these people who's always reading reviews of books rather than the books themselves.
And those journals are so huge anyway, they take up so much space on the coffee table.
Yeah, that's right, absolutely. And so there's that. And then also I like these collections very much. And I like the kind of, I mean, in a way, the more diverse, the better. So I'd look forward every 8 years or whatever it was to when Updike would put together his kind of latest 900-page installment of his occasional writings.
Although you wind up with a book review of something that's been long out of print.
There's that. But, I mean, the criteria that I was working with about what to include is that I felt each of the pieces had to, even if it was quite short, it had to raise or make some point that had a relevance and resonance that was beyond the immediate occasion for the review. So that actually, let's take an example, even if the reader of this book hadn't actually read Dennis Johnson's Tree of Smoke, which I was ostensibly reviewing, some larger point is being made there that would also be a point that's not tied so precisely to, you know, to that particular moment when the book came out.
Well, you write about contemporary writers, but also you write about F. Scott Fitzgerald here, D.H. Lawrence. You've actually divided the book into five sections: visuals, verbals, musicals, variables, and personals. Personals being personal essays. You want to explain what the others are?
Yeah, actually, I'll do it in reverse order then. I felt it was useful for personals to come at the end, the way that personals do in like classified ads in a newspaper. So the first bit in the book, it's, visuals, and that's mainly writings on photography. Then there's verbals, and you're right, there's a division there between reviews of contemporary books and these these longer essays, and I'll say something about those if I may. I mean, we always imagine ambition operating at the level of some sort of vast project like I want to win the Nobel Prize. But the truth is, it doesn't actually. I think ambition typically comes in these rather small incremental forms. And I was always hoping that one day I'd get asked to write an introduction to a classic book that I loved. And these longer essays are, that's what they are. They're introductions to these books. And for me, I mean, I'm just so happy to do that.
Well, should I assume that because you wrote an introduction to Sons and Lovers, that that's a favorite?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it seems to me madness to introduce a book that you're not absolutely besotted with. I mean, that would. I mean, I can see why you would, write negative reviews of a book when it comes out, or there might be you might use the occasion to take down somebody's reputation. But, I mean, for me, I just love the way that, you know. I mean, there's a piece not included in this book, but I've just written an introduction to Roland Barthes' Camera Lucida. And if I'd imagined when I first read that book, age 21, that I would end up between the covers with Roland Barthes. I mean, my word. I mean, I think it's just it's the nicest thing that can happen to you as a reader to do that.
You've also written introductions for John Cheever, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and others. And one of your early books, Out of Sheer Rage, Wrestling with D.H. Lawrence, is an account of trying and failing to write a book about Lawrence.
Yeah, but as the truth...
Had you hoped to be an academic when you were at Oxford? Is that what that grows out of?
No, I was very fortunate in that I was not influenced at all by my tutor, who was one of these young tutors who, right from the word go, made it so obvious that teaching his students was a burdensome intrusion on his time, which he would much rather spend doing other things. And I'm really glad that I didn't become one of these people who joined the cult of Terry Eagleton or something like that, because actually it meant that when I found a mentor, if you like, it was after I'd left university, and it was a much more informal relationship with a much greater man than any tutor at Oxford could be, it seemed to me. That was the great writer John Berger.
Mm-hmm. Who is, like you, a generalist.
Yeah,
in an essay called My Life as a Gatecrasher, you quote Nietzsche on the subject of people who, quote, study and prowl around a single domain simply because it never occurs to them that other domains exist.
Yeah, he talks about these specialists. He says they have the tremendous stupidity of gravity. And it was certainly from Berger that I got this... I got the encouragement and the confidence to write about a great variety of things. Actually, I should say, at the same time that I was discovering Berger, I was also discovering, you know, your homegrown Susan Sontag. You know, these were really, I'm really glad I fell under the spell of people like this, because the academic path, of course, encourages you to finer and finer specialisms.
Well, the French have a history of this, the public intellectual. We have less. So the Bergers, the Sontags, the people who are ready to talk about pretty much anything, in some cases Sontag getting it all wrong, but that's
indeed
beside the point.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just by simply addressing these issues and exciting other people to think about them, they are performing a real service. Why do you think that doesn't happen as much in English language writing?
It certainly doesn't happen in Britain. And, years ago, I mean, as everybody does, as many writers do in their 20s, I went to live in Paris. And the reason for that was very simple, really, because you could sort of... Paris cafes were cool, whereas it seemed to me at that time, to exaggerate slightly, if you were seen reading a book in a pub, in England, you could get beaten up, you know. But actually, since then, I've come to rather like the English skepticism about the being a public intellectual. I mean, to go back to Paris, of course, these people like Foucault, Roland Barthes, all this kind of thing. I mean, they weren't just public intellectuals; they were celebrity intellectuals, weren't they? They were real superstars. And I guess. For a while we had Michael Ignatieff. He was over there in Britain, and then he did the decent thing and went back to Canada.
And lost an election recently. Yeah. Jeff Dyer is my guest. His latest book is otherwise known as The Human Condition, Selected Essays and Reviews. You mentioned you lived in Paris for a while. You've said that although you live in London, your fantasy is to live in San Francisco. Why don't you just – you've lived in different cities over the years. Why not just move to San Francisco?
Yeah. Oh, well, because my wife really likes her job in London. And but, yeah, you know, I really – I was saying to this guy who runs a photography gallery in San Francisco, I was saying, you know, I really want to end my days in San Francisco. And he said, you've got that wrong. You don't end your days in San Francisco. You begin them. So I like to think I've got a – there's a little while before it – it's not so – I don't have to do it tomorrow, but certainly I'd feel very – I'd feel I'd really sold myself short if I didn't get to San Francisco to live at some point.
Well, you mentioned the cafes of Paris, and it's obviously like cafes. And San Francisco, it seems to me, at 4 o'clock in the afternoon when New Yorkers are working really hard – everybody's out in a cafe in San Francisco.
Yeah, I mean, I'm attracted to that very much. I mean, New York and London are very similar in that they're, you know, cities of ambition and work and drive and getting on. I like the slight, I don't want to be insulting, I like the slightly more dropout feel that you get in, or people, you know, really having a high quality of life, which is not determined so much by your work.
Your variable section seems to be mainly travel writing, going to Paris fashion shows or the 2004 Olympics. And you wrote a piece for Esquire about flying a MiG-29 fighter jet, which you called the wrong stuff. Did you do those things on assignment?
All of them were, they were suggested to me. But of course, like, you know, I'm 52. Like any, I was going to say, any guy of my age, God, I think any boy anywhere. I mean, I'd always loved sort of jets and stuff, so that was fantastic. Just to correct you about the piece about the Olympics and, you know, it being a travel piece, it was done entirely in front of my television.
Well, that's a way many of us travel these days.
Yeah, well, actually, I mean, one of the things I would stress is that it seems to me that a lot of the essays in this book, even if they don't involve me going any place other than my desk, they're journeys in the sense that I begin often in a state of relative ignorance and come to some kind of knowledge or understanding. So they're, hopefully, if it doesn't sound too boasting to say it, I think they're epistemological journeys.
Well, it could be a journey to the local donut shop. The title essay, otherwise known as The Human Condition, actually has a subtitle with particular reference to donut plant donuts, an account of your obsession with a particular brand of donut?
Yeah, and this is no more really than the prelude, the overture to what will be my great magnum opus, Great Pastries of the World, : A Personal View.
Now, you've written, the donut shop is here in New York, right?
The donut plant is in the Lower East Side, and also they've now opened one in the Chelsea Hotel, actually.
You have written a lot of personal essays. Have you ever thought of going all the way and writing a memoir?
Do you know, that's interesting you ask this, because as soon as I saw them in this book, these kind of things about growing up as a only child.
Or meeting your wife.
Yeah, all of that
stuff.
Or
living on the dole.
Yeah.
These are all memoir material.
I kind of started to wish maybe I'd not included them in this piece, so that they could all be, put together and added to in a separate volume. Weirdly, although people would say I've written an indecent amount about myself, I'm not particularly drawn to the idea of the memoir. Although my wife is always urging me to write a memoir about my childhood because of its incredible ordinariness.
Well, a lot of people are uncomfortable writing the word I all the time, but there's no way you can get around it unless you make yourself into a character.
Yeah, that's right. And the I, for example, in Out of Sheer Rage that you mentioned earlier, I mean, that's a voice, it's a persona, it's an aspect of my character that's exaggerated. And the thing is, it's like the sort of Montaigne thing in terms of the essays. And this is the wager, it seems to me, that's going on. It's obviously you want to convey some kind of universal truth to your readers, but the wager is actually by remaining absolutely true to the vagaries of your own nature and the contingencies of your own experience. It's by doing that, paradoxically, that you will probably speak to people whose circumstances and temperament have almost nothing in common with your own.
Would the people you grew up with in Cheltenham in the working class neighborhood be surprised to see you where you are today?
I guess so, but I mean, we have to go back, you see. So I was born in 1958. So I was the beneficiary of this, you know, the post-war settlement, whereby there were all sorts of provisions in place for, you know, taking people like me to grammar school and then on to university. So it wasn't, I mean, one of the things I really stress is that this didn't, what happened to me didn't require any sort of active agency on my part. I just kept passing exams. I just passively rode this educational escalator, which took me from grammar school to Oxford and so on like that. And of course, at each stage of that process, all sorts of your life opportunities are expanding until by the time you get to Oxford, then, you know, then goodness knows, you're coming across all sorts of people who've got, you know, really grand ideas to become, I don't know, prime minister or something.
What's next, another novel?
No, what's next is, let me preface this by saying that I rather arrogantly sent a note to my agent, and I said, I think you'll agree that it's my greatest achievement. To explain that, I was contracted to write a book about tennis, which I found I had no desire to do. So I set about summarizing in incredible detail Andrei Tarkovsky's film Stalker. Previous to that claim about my greatest achievement, I said, I think you'll agree, in terms of my absolute indifference to what the market might want or a publisher might reasonably expect, this is my greatest achievement.
Jeff Dyer has won the Somerset Maugham Prize, the Bollinger Everyman Woodhouse Prize for Comic Fiction, a Lannan Literary Award, the International Center for Photography's 2006 Infinity Award for Writing on Photography, and the American Academy of Arts and Letters E.M. Forster Award. His latest book is otherwise known as The Human Condition, Selected Essays and Reviews, published by Grey Wolf Press. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you. Great pleasure.